Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Well, I do love a good chocolate chip cookie. Throw a sugar cookie in there as well. And we are talking about cookies this morning, but not those kinds. Joining me now is Dr. Vahid Bezadun. He is our cybersecurity expert. Vahid, what kind of cookies are you talking about?
Well, not the delicious kind. Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you're talking about internet cookies, correct?
That's correct, yes. You might have noticed if you visit a new website these days, they typically show some form of warning or agreement that says, we are using cookies. Are you okay with us using cookies or not? And we typically just click on yes, everything is okay. Just let us use the website.
Right.
Now, these cookies used to be and still are very useful tools. The internet is like Dory from Finding Nemo or Finding Dory. It's a little short in terms of memory. Every time you go to a web page, the web protocol looks at you as if you are a completely new person asking for something for the first time. Like, if you go to a website that requires you to log in, like Facebook, without additional help, you would need to log in every time you visit a new page. And that just sounds painful. A solution that was proposed about 25, 26 years ago was to store something on your browser, on your computer, that reminds the web server or the website of who you are and what you're doing on that website. That information is saved in a text file called a cookie. So cookies are files that are stored on our own computers and on in our own web browsers, and typically they store some information about who we are and what we're doing on that website. All seems good. It sounds like a very useful thing to have, and by it I mean cookies, until you go on a shopping website, an online shop, you look for something that you're interested in, let's say jeans or some service, or if you're planning a trip to the mountains and you're looking at the hotels, and then you go on Facebook and you see all the ads on Facebook are now about jeans or
yes. So is that why? So that's why that happens. So I guess the reason it's clicking for me, Vahid, is, you know, people always say, oh, you know, your apps are probably hearing you. But is it because of the cookies that they then are like, oh, well, she searched for this, so now we're going to have all this generating on the side advertisement bars when you're on social media?
That's one of the mechanisms for this pervasive and tracking behavior. These days, websites do not store just minimal useful information about who you are for their own purposes. If you go to, let's say, CNET.com, which is for tech news, or if you go on LinkedIn, there's a lot of information saved on your computer in different cookies that are solely there to track your behavior across different websites. And this has become a problem. It's not just the fact that Facebook now knows more about your web browsing history than your own browser does. It's the fact that they use this information, they share this information with other parties for marketing purposes, for advertisement, for this is a somewhat recent and emerging trend for adaptive and dynamic pricing purposes, and so on. So cookies are the primary means of how our activity is tracked on the internet these days.
It makes sense. I'm just curious, Vahid, you know, is there a way to clear your cookies? Like, should we be actively, when we get, you know, when we're done with the internet, should we be clearing our cookies to try and have a little more privacy? Is that possible?
That's the thing. Cookies, some cookies are still very useful. You wouldn't want to log back into Facebook using your username and password every time you go on Facebook.com. Or you wouldn't want to log back into other social media accounts every time throughout the day that you want to visit particular social media. And for those purposes, you do need a certain type of cookies called session cookies. Now, in the past year or so, web browser developers and companies have become a little more friendly towards people who do not want to be tracked. And on certain browsers like Chrome, Firefox, Edge, and Safari, on desktop computers, you can go on to the settings and disable third-party cookies. Third-party cookies are cookies that are stored on your computer by a website for use by other websites. And that's how tracking is essentially enabled across websites. Can enable this particular option to make sure that the bad kind of cookies are not stored on your computer at all. But this isn't a silver bullet. This doesn't always work. This doesn't disable all third-party or tracking cookies. So another thing that one might want to do is to, when they see that we are using cookies, are you okay with this notice on a web page, mm-hmm. instead of clicking on OK, you might want to click on more information.
Okay. So maybe instead of just always clicking yes because we are impatient and we want to access it, maybe we just take a second and we read it really closely. Dr. Vahid Bezadun is here. He is our cybersecurity expert. And Vahid, I know we were talking about cookies, but I do want to go to another topic as well because we only get to have you once every couple of weeks. So I want to take advantage. Ahead of the holiday season especially, I know a lot of people are going to buy smart toys or even children's cameras, baby cams, for their homes, and you have some security and privacy issues with some of these connected smart toys or nanny cams. What can you tell us?
Well, just like any other connected device, these devices are also prone to compromise. And that would entail a stranger getting access to the nanny cam and just use it to spy on you, your family, and everything else.
Also, how do they do that? How does that happen?
Oh, that's that's actually quite easy in many cases.
Really?
It's a little scary.
Oh, I don't like that.
Many of these devices, there's a default password, the default set of usernames and passwords mm-hmm. that one can use to access the device and, enjoy the view, essentially. And also, some of these devices were not developed with security in mind, so they may use an older piece of software or older operating system, which may be riddled with vulnerabilities. And exploiting those are quite easy for even novice hackers, those who are not professionals.
Very comforting.
So, indeed. So it's very important to make sure that, first of all, the device that you are purchasing, the connected device that you're purchasing, be it a nanny cam or a connected toy, is secure and is up to date. Before purchasing the device, just search for the device name, the manufacturer's name and brand, and then the marketing name of the device, plus vulnerability and see what comes up. Then you, the first thing one might want to do when they purchase one of these devices is to change the default username and password. That shouldn't be too difficult. The setup guide should include the steps for changing these default credentials. And lastly, you need to monitor the internet usage of that device. So you may know times that you've accessed a particular device or used a particular device, like a nanny cam. You can go back to the log files on your internet access point at home and see if the device has made use of the internet more frequently or at a higher bandwidth at different times. And that can be a warning sign. Of course, these devices need to communicate with the internet quite regularly and frequently just to check in and right. see what's new. Those are small pieces of traffic. But if there's video streaming going on, that's something that will immediately pop up when you look at the log files on your access point. In general, any connected device is prone to being hacked, including connected toys and connected cameras like nanny cams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely things to really think about. And Vahid, we so appreciate that we have you as an asset and somebody who consistently comes on the show to give us the heads up on these things. Thank you so much. And we will talk again after Thanksgiving. So have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family. We'll talk to you in December.
Same to you. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Vahid. Appreciate it.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Senator Blumenthal, good morning. My understanding is you're joining the call for a Federal Trade Commission investigation into the soaring gas prices we're all having to deal with. What prompted you to want to get on board with this?
What prompted me to call for this investigation last week, even before the president did so, and also for release of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve gasoline or oil that can be converted to gasoline, is essentially the surge in gasoline prices that threatens our economic recovery. It's pretty obvious to anyone who drives, as I do a lot in the state of Connecticut, going from Fairfield County up to Hartford whenever I'm in Connecticut and all around the state. I watch these gas prices rise astronomically, but equally troubling their effect on the economy, the ripple effect in impeding the job market and wage growth for low-paid and middle-income workers, and the impact on ordinary Americans of having to pay these astronomic prices. And further, what really made me eager to have this investigation is the mounting evidence that some of the big oil companies are actually profiting at rising rates because the cost of refined fuel to them has diminished while the prices at the pump have increased. So their profit margins are bigger than ever. And we need to look into that kind of profiteering.
So, Senator Blumenthal, can you just reiterate? So what do you think big oil is hiding from the rest of us?
What it's hiding in plain sight is the fact that their costs, in other words, the refined fuel costs to them, are as much as 25 cents less per gallon than they were before. In other words, the cost of their product is declining, but obviously the cost of what they sell, gasoline prices at the pump, have increased dramatically by as much as a dollar in some place around the country. The increase of about a dollar per gallon has really impacted our psychology in terms of economic recovery. It's impacted business decisions. It's impacted ordinary consumers.
My only question, and look, Senator Blumenthal, I can't disagree with you. I go to the pump and I don't even want to fill up my gas all the way because it's painful. it hurts point blank. But how would they get away with something like that when it's so blatantly obvious how much money, how much more money we are spending in such a quick amount of time? How would they get away with that for so long?
Well, Melissa, it's called the free market. You know, they pay a certain amount for refined fuel. If they shared some of the diminished prices that they're paying with consumers, the cost of gasoline would be 25 cents less per gallon. That is, if the gap between their refined costs and gasoline prices at the pump were to return to normal pre-pandemic levels, they are free, if there is a completely free market, to charge whatever the market will bear. But the reason for the FTC investigation is, in fact, the contention that they are potentially colluding, in other words, agreeing with each other to higher pump prices, or in some way otherwise deceiving consumers and hiding the cost to them. So if there is wrongdoing of that kind, it's not a free market.
Have they done this before, Senator Blumenthal?
Absolutely. Anybody familiar with the history of gasoline prices knows that there have been these astronomic surges before, and there have been investigations before. And the investigations themselves often have a positive effect. Once they know that the FTC or state attorneys general, which I was, and we did investigation, are looking over their shoulder, they may behave differently.
So what can, I mean, so what comes out of these investigations, Senator Blumenthal? Like, give us an example. I mean, you know, obviously, I would hope we'd see the gas prices go back down dramatically. But, you know, what happens to big oil companies to at least try to assure that this doesn't happen for a long time, or until at least the next alleged crook comes in and does this again?
If the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, finds and demonstrates collusion or misleading or deceptive marketing practices or other violations of law, they can fine the oil companies. Now, let's be real, these are multi-billion dollar companies.
Sure.
And the fine has to be sufficient to really be more than the cost of doing business. Often it's not, but it at least informs consumers, and it could lead, ultimately, if there is an antitrust investigation, into a breakup of the big oil company. Now, that's more a hope than an expectation. If you look at the history of antitrust enforcement, this would be a tremendous step forward. But we see these price increases periodically. In this instance, remember, we've had a pandemic. Consumers are going back to the road, so the demand has increased. More people want to buy it. Therefore, there might be an expectation of some price increase. Also, OPEC, the nations that produce oil in the Middle East, have gotten together and decided they're not going to meet the shortage of oil on the market. And there have been various other disruptions in supply chains and so forth. Everybody knows about them. But the point here is that there is a widening gap between the cost of refined fuel for the companies and what they're charging.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, again, joining the call for a Federal Trade Commission investigation into the soaring gas prices, and an investigation overdue and necessary for the big oil companies. We appreciate your help, and thank you so much for coming on to talk about it this morning, Senator. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll talk, in the next week. We'll talk in early December.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
The five strangest animals at the zoo. Apparently, there are all kinds of lists online about the world's strangest animals, and we actually have five of them at the Beardsley Zoo. Joining me now is Greg Dancho, of course. Greg, first of all, how do you even land on the strangest animals list? Like, what qualifies you to be considered a strange animal?
consider me the sixth of the strangest animals at the zoo. So,
oh, no, it's fine, Greg.
I guess if you go online, you can find lists on anything, and we know that. If you want to search things, you can search on just about anything, the most strangest animals. See, I don't consider them strange. I consider them unique.
I consider these animals unique. Yes.
Yeah. And so I'm not saying strange. I think unique. In the evolutionary process of the planet, you know, these animals have evolved into some strange, you know, area looks and feels and what they do. But I think these animals are just a part of our zoo family here. So we're really excited to have them here. You know, we've talked about this before on the show that we have some of the most endangered species of animals on the planet here in Connecticut Spirit Zoo. But we also have these animals that, you know, again, have made the list. So we'll go down them real quick. We do have five of them here, and some of them are fan favorites. Our sloth make the list. And the reason sloth are on the list is because they move very slowly, as we know. They live their lives upside down. But some people don't realize that they only come to ground. Some sloths will only come to ground once a week to go to the bathroom.
Oh, how interesting. Wait, that's crazy.
Our sloths about every 2-3 days. Will come down. Our species of sloth will come down for about every 2 or 3 days. And they'll climb down slowly out of their tree, come down, and what they go to, it's called a midden. And then the midden is where they will go to the bathroom and then climb back up the tree and wait another 2 or 3 days to come back down to their bathroom down on the ground. Also, not only that, but they move so slowly, they develop a moss on their fur. They live in the trees, and they develop actually algae that grows on the fur because they don't move around a lot, and they don't really take baths. And there is a certain type of moth. It's called a Cecropia moth that actually lives off of the sloth.
No.
It's life cycle on the sloth. The
Cecropia
moth will lay their eggs on the sloth. The eggs will hatch. They'll eat the algae that is growing on the sloth, and then the moths will then pupate and fly off. So if you don't have a sloth, you don't have a Cecropia moth.
That's just one of the strange.
That is a pretty strange thing.
I'll give you strange on that one. That's fair.
Down next on the list, we have Chacoan peccary. Chacoan peccary here at the zoo. We call them, you know, they're one of the most endangered species of pig from South America. But the strange thing about them is a lot of people didn't think that they could survive in the Northeast. They were in a few zoos around the country, but when we said, well, we'd like to have them here at Connecticut Spirit Zoo, they said, well, they really won't fit here because they won't do very well. And when we brought them here for the first time ever into the Northeast, for any zoo in the Northeast, they did very well. Actually, had a baby here. They have tiny, tiny little legs, very huge bodies, and they were almost not found for many, many years because they were very shy in their wild state. So, but they are the largest of the South American pecker pigs or peccaries. So that makes them pretty cool. The maned wolf, everybody kind of knows the maned wolf. I mean, we always talk about them. They're one of our favorites at the zoo.
Yes.
The maned wolf, we call them the fox on stilts because they've got such long legs. People don't realize they're a wolf. They're actually their own species unto themselves. But what a lot of people don't realize, it makes them even stranger if they have this really pungent smell.
Yes, they do.
And if you get downwind from them, they have a really pungent smell, and that really helps them in the wild to be able to locate each other when they're in these tall grass areas in the pampas areas. And that smell, some people will say this, that it has a very, very close aroma to marijuana.
Yes, I was going to say that. I was like, if he doesn't say it, I will. I definitely thought someone was like smoking pot at the zoo. And I thought, well, this is kind of new, well, and I don't know how to feel about it. But it was, in fact,
one of the zoos in Amsterdam that had maned wolf actually had the police call to their facility because somebody thought that somebody had broken into the zoo and were having a pot party in the zoo. And we have people that will come to us every once in a while and ask us that question.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, what's going on. And we have to say it's the maned wolf.
That's so funny. So
that makes them one of the stranger of our animals. The second on our list is our vampire bats. Vampire bats, again, just because their name, it's a vampire bat.
Right.
We have just males here at the zoo. There is no reason for it to have baby vampire bats. They're very prolific, actually, when you put them together. So we don't want to have an overpopulation of vampire bats here. They do drink blood. We do feed them blood here at the zoo. We get blood from a slaughterhouse, actually, that gives us blood. We have to process it because blood coagulates very quickly. And the way the vampire bat gets its food is they will make a bite into a victim, whether it's a cow or a person or an animal that's in the rainforest, and they have an anticoagulant in their saliva, which keeps the blood from thickening up. Because this way, if they thick enough very quick, they couldn't eat. So what they do is when they bite you, they will put the saliva on there, which keep the blood from thickening, and that way they can have their meal. And a lot of people and animals that are bitten by vampire bats will bleed for a long time afterward because their blood will not coagulate up and seal up the wound.
Wow.
So that makes it very interesting.
That is
and
crazy.
our last on the list here at the zoo, we have our axolotl. That's a big word. It's a lot of, people may not even know the axolotl.
I don't know what that is, yeah.
The axolotl lives in our rainforest building, and it's relatively hard to see. Axolotls live underwater. They come from, they're a salamander that comes from the lake in Mexico, one lake in Mexico, and they are now a critically endangered species in Mexico. There's a bunch of nuns that are actually trying to keep these animals alive in this lake,
aww,
which is very interesting. But what's interesting about it, what makes them strange, is they retain their neonatal form. Neonatal form means usually with salamanders, they'll be hatched in a pond. They'll turn into an aquatic creature, right, which have gills and breathe underwater. And then what they'll do is metamorphosize and then come out of the water and live on the land and then go back to the water to have procreate. In axolotls, they never go past the neonatal form. They stay as a neonatal or larval form for their entire lives. They'll breed that way. They'll get to maturity that way also. But they spend their entire life underwater. They breathe underwater. They have gills that absorb the oxygen from the water. And they never change. And that's really what makes them very strange. However, if they're getting to an environment where the water level starts to drop and gets a little warmer, they can revert to an adult land form, a salamander.
Interesting.
Which is, again, pretty, pretty dang cool. So that,
wow,
that I guess, and our list of five, that is our number one of the animals that have the coolest adaptations.
Yeah.
And I think they're really neat.
It is really neat. It is, and I learned a lot about some of them. I got to be honest, the sloth really throws me. My God, the bladder control on those guys. That's incredible. I'm really impressed. Really, really impressed. My goodness. Well, Greg Dancho of our Zoo Minute.
So today, remember, today is our last day of voting. Last day of voting for the mayor of the zoo. It ends today at 4,
oh, yes,
4 o'clock.
Yes.
So right now we have, and I think some people have been keep asking me who's in the lead right now. It's neck and neck with Harry out in the farmyard and Claire, Harry our pig, and Claire our bison is neck and neck. The other ones are coming up pretty strong.
Ooh.
We may see Jolene. She's getting down with it, and she's working
down
really hard. So
yes,
we hope
you get
the traction. So again, if you have a favorite, get on our Facebook page and vote today. Your last chance to vote for our mayor of the zoo.
Oh, I appreciate that. Greg Dancho of the Beardsley Zoo, we always appreciate having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Sounds good.